To your point, Frank, absolutely. The mental focus is so essential in these races.
You have to have a reason for doing it, too.
Right.
For doing that run.
Yes.
There has to be a good reason, not just to do it to do it. There has to be a good reason to do it.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
You're out on that trail for 24 to 30 hours. You're there, you and your mind. So
right.
You want to so do you think, oh my God, I have another 50 miles? You start thinking that way.
3, 4, 5, 6, check.
And my boyfriend is jealous of the Cocopelli.
Yeah. Are we recording?
I'll say I'm Faith Goss. You say I'm Don Freeman. And, oh, okay. Faith Goss is about Warren Don Freeman.
Okay.
Yeah. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
Recording.
And action.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Faith Goss.
I'm Scott Ward.
I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Mike Hernandez.
And today we are joined by Dr. Frank Lieberman. He is a psychologist, and he's written the book, It Has Nothing to Do with Age, Stories of Driven Athletes Who Compete in Extraordinary Sports. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You know, I've had a chance to look at the book and go through some of the stories and the numerous people that Frank has known and rubbed shoulders with and competed with, and he shares with us some great tales. One of his messages is right in the very title of the book. It says, I'll edit this part. What does it say?
It has nothing to do with age.
Okay.
You're so young.
I didn't have my book. It has nothing to do with age. In 2000, at the age of 60, he competed in the Tevis Cup, a 100-mile endurance horse event over the rugged Sierra Nevada mountains. 2 years after that, Frank took on that same event, but without a horse. He decided to do it on his own 2 feet. He was a division winner. He didn't just complete this event, but a division winner in the 100-mile endurance run Western States from Squaw Valley down to Auburn through the rugged mountains again. At the age of 68, he came in first place in the Swanton Pacific. Did I say that right, Frank?
Swanton, yeah.
Swanton. Swanton Pacific 100-mile ride and tie. You're going to have to tell us a little bit about a couple of these events, because there's some of us that don't know exactly what all three of these things are. We're pretty well versed in the 100-mile Western States run. But tell us a little bit about what you did at the Tevis Cup.
Okay.
We certainly don't want to miss any good stories about Western States. And then what is a ride and tie?
Okay.
Welcome, Frank.
Thank you. Thank you, Don. No, that's great.
Good.
So let's see. So first question is, what is the Tevis?
What is the Tevis Cup?
Well, the Tevis Cup is a 100-mile, one-day horse race that started in the 50s. A man by the name of Wendell Roby was promoting the foothills up here in Auburn. And so what he wanted to do is to create some interest in this area. So he, along with five other people, did this 100-mile race in one day.
Anything been done like that, or was it just his own?
That was his idea. I mean, you know, could it be done?
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of controversy around it, and a lot of the horse people were against that. I mean, how would you take a horse and submit it to that grueling race day and night? How would you do it?
Right. How would you get the fuel that they needed, or the water, or keep them cool, because those canyons get hot?
Mm-hmm. Well, back then
Frank, how far did the Pony Express riders go? How far did the typical horse go on one of those legs?
Now, yeah. Scott, he was born in 1939, not 1839.
That was before my time, Scott.
No, I know that. I'm just saying that you're a horse guy. You probably know a little bit about the Pony Express.
Very little.
Okay.
Only that they didn't go that far. They went they went short distances. They had to, as in the movies, had to outrace the Indians chasing them. So, I mean, come on.
Okay.
Good question, Scott.
Thanks.
What was our question?
I don't know. It was
the Tevis and Wendell Roby. So he started the ride. So it started in the, I forget, 54, 55. He did the first ride. So along with these five other gentlemen. And back then, one man, he carried 50 pounds of additional equipment like horseshoes and things like that. This was unheard of in terms of what they did. But these men, were all men, and they did finish this ride. And then it's become really popular and was like the one of the most difficult rides because of the trail conditions.
And was that one of the inaugural endurance races of its kind?
That
in
was
terms
the,
of,
that right, was okay. The race of its time.
And, they exist today.
It's the granddaddy.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it's still going on. It's the granddaddy of its sport.
Now, I've been and witnessed part of that race, and, mm-hmm. and what I've seen, those horses are remarkable athletes. Oh, my goodness. At the end of the race, just looking at the musculature, and just, they're beautiful.
Wow.
They're athletes.
Well, Nick, make no mistake, I think the riders have to be pretty amazing athletes. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, you have to be a good rider. You have to know what you're doing. Yes. So yeah, you have to really be knowledgeable about that particular race because it's a very technical ride.
Mm-hmm.
Very technical, especially the first part where you're up early in the morning. It's cold, and these horses, they just want to go. They're conditioned to taking off and riding fast and so forth, and they don't want to slow down. And so then, of course, as you know, that part of the terrain from Roby Park, you're going downhill, you're going through rocks, and it's a tough race. It's surprising that more horses don't get injured. Just like Western States, there's about a 50% completion rate.
For the horses, 50% will drop?
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed is that the horses look a lot better than the athletes. The runners, when they're done with the race, we look like we've just gone through a war, but those horses still look very strong.
Yeah, it depends upon when you're at the finish line, of course. Just like, so if you're at the finish line, 17 hours Western States, yeah, the runners look pretty good. The same way if you're at the finish line early on in the Tevis, the horses look good.
Ah.
And so it's difficult. But you ought to go to Forest Hill and watch the horses come up
Bath Road.
Just watch them and sometimes they do look better than the riders because the riders are grubby and dirty and tired and filthy. And
what's the longevity for a horse? How many years can a horse compete in that? I know we're supposed to be talking about age, doesn't matter, but this is all very interesting.
This is part of it.
Yeah.
Well, same thing, like once again, you've heard the expression speed kills.
Right.
Okay. Well, with an endurance horse, by the same token, you push that endurance horse, and you're going to shorten its life.
Hmm.
So if you're out there, there's been a few exceptions. A few women riders have had horses that have held up longer. But basically, you're only talking about 3 or 4 years.
Hmm.
I'm talking about somebody who's coming in top 10.
You hear that, Scott? We cannot run fast any longer because it will shorten our lifespan as runners. So we got to run easy
just
and
like
slow.
Just like the horse.
I've never had that problem.
Do we have any horses that can be considered the Ann Trayson or the Tim Twitmire of Tevis?
Oh, sure. Becky Hart, I forget the name of her horse at the moment, but she did very well with her horse. And maybe the name will come back to me during the podcast, but at the moment I blocked on it. But yeah, there's some horses like that have just been phenomenal.
Well, what type of horses?
Primarily Arabians.
Mm-hmm. The best for that environment.
Yeah, they're built, and their breathing capacity, and yeah, they just. They're tough horses.
Now, I don't know much about horses, but I'm going to drop a little horse knowledge here on you.
Stand by.
And it came from Lee McKinley on a run, and he told me this, so I really can't take all the credit for it, but he told me about the mule has the ability to take its hoof and place it laterally or whatever, wherever he needs to or she needs to for good foot placement. But a horse, on the other hand, will just drive and smack it down and let it land wherever it lands. So if that's not correct, that was Lee. And if it is correct, then I'm just dispensing good information.
I really don't know the answer to that, but horses do get injured. But what I do know is that when the horse puts its front feet down, the back feet land in the same place as the front feet, basically.
Are they forehoof striking? Or...
Very good, yes. Scott. They are definitely forefoot strikers.
There you go. Yeah, they do that. Yeah, when they're not
Scott's
lame.
The next horse whisperer. He's going to teach heel striking in horses.
So I always thought a mule, just from my old cowboy rodeo days, was a lot more... would be a lot more conducive to the trails.
Well, on this particular ride, my one of my shoers, he completed 10 Tevises with the mule. So he did very well. But they're once again the exception, as opposed to the... No one's going to win the Tevis on a mule.
Oh, is that right? So mules will not win.
So I consider myself a mule, so you just... My Western
only
State
on the
days.
Only on the Tevis. I'm talking about the Tevis now. I'm not talking about Western State.
Okay. Well, there's still hope, Don, for all of us.
That's right. Only the Tevis.
Now, the other thing I want to come back to with Don here, for some reason or other, can a mule be a female? Or I thought that was a ginny. So,
oh, really?
We're
going
to have to talk with Mr. McKinley about
so
this.
I wanted to drop horse knowledge, but I just blew my cover completely when I
don't
is that like a rooster
sure.
and a hen?
We're going to have to go back and take a look at all
All right. I'm sure somebody's Googling that right now
somebody's
trying to figure it out.
Somebody's going to have to help us out there.
So I have a question, Frank, because we're still on the horses.
Sure.
How does a horse see at night? We run around with headlamps on our head. You know, do you put a headlamp on your horse? I mean,
God, no. They have night vision.
Oh, stealth.
I have no horse knowledge.
That is the key, because basically when you ride that California loop, generally it's in the dark, right? And you don't want to have your LED light on because you're going to possibly blind your horse.
Huh.
So basically, you trust your horse. So, for example, when you're on that California loop, okay, there's glow sticks, so that's okay. But let's say your horse stops at a moment. You don't want to push your horse forward because he may be stopping, likely for a good reason. So you have to trust your horse.
Do these horses get competitive one with another?
They're herd animals.
So they like to run together.
They like to be together. They don't like to be left.
Well, will some of the front-running horses drag some of those less qualified and take you out of the
match? Yeah, there's
match?
One. I'll give you one good example. Three people train together. Potato Richardson, he's won the Tevis.
That's his name, Potato?
His Potato, yeah.
All right.
Potato.
French fries, baked potato.
Tomato,
sour cream, whatever. But
sour cream, Bauer cream?
Mr. Potato.
But basically, he rode with his wife. I don't know if they were married at the time, but they were. It became his wife. And also one of their stable mates. And the three of them rode, and they came in first, second, and third.
Interesting.
So... whether that would have, if those three people would have ridden maybe separately, who knows what would have happened. But yeah, they're herd animals, so they can be pulled.
Tell us about the aid station, because we're used to our aid stations. We pull in, we fib a little bit to the person weighing us, telling them that's exactly our weight. We jam some food in us, and off we go. Something different happens at your aid stations at Tevis Cup.
Well, at the aid station, there are some aid stations that there's a required hold. So, like, let's say at Robinson Flat.
That's what I want, Mike. A required hold.
Yes.
Yeah. Retired.
Your time is still running, but it's still a required hold. So there's an hour hold. So basically, what you want to do is your horse's pulse and respiration are checked immediately, and if they meet criteria, then the hour starts at that particular point. So when you are coming into Robinson Flat, so what I did, maybe a quarter or half mile prior to Robinson Flat.
And Robinson Flat's about what, 26 miles in, 30 miles?
26.
In that? Okay.
I got off my horse, loosened the girth, took out the tie rope, and ran with my horse so that its pulse and respiration would come down, so that when I hit Robinson Flat, okay, give me a check the pulse and respiration. If it met criteria, then that hour started. Mm-hmm. So at that point, then you would get a vet evaluation that mm-hmm. would evaluate the horse for soundness and respiration and so forth. And if you pass that, then you know your saddle is off the horse and the horse is eating, drinking, hopefully, and just relaxing while you're eating, drinking, relaxing, and you have crew there to take care of your horse. That's ideal. So it's some of the other vet checks, maybe a 15-minute hold or just a trot by, they're checking for soundness. So usually at Robinson Flat, most of the horses are pulled because of lameness.
Mm. Pulled from the race?
Yeah, because they've gone too fast. And then another problem is their hydration, because at the beginning of a race, the horses don't want to drink. And so there's a lot of pulls at Robinson.
I'm curious, what does a horse aid station buffet table look like? Because I don't think it's what I'm thinking.
Well,
oats. You would bring, yeah.
Carrots.
If you liked carrots, and you'd bring carrots for your horse. If you would feed your horse, basically. Now at Robinson, the water is pretty cold up there because you know the elevation at that time of the year. So you get water early and you put it in a bucket, put it in the sun to warm it, and then of course take the chill out. And then you'd have, if your horse is eating alfalfa or grass or combination, you would have that available. And then you'd create a mash for your horse. Might be beet pulp, it might be grain, it might be, and carrots, apples. So it's like a little smorgasbord there for the horse. And hopefully your horse is going to eat, and you're massaging it, and you're just letting it be a horse. And then, of course, you're watching your watch.
Yeah.
And then when that hour is close to the hour, you're saddle up and you're ready to go again.
Now, I've run along that course, and I have found humongous syringes of electrolyte stuff.
Yes.
And I have one at home, because I know there may be a time that I am in terrible shape and that will pull me out of anything. But potassium in it, it has everything. I don't think I'll...
I hope it's not a horse tranquilizer.
I don't know what it is, but I picked it up and put it in my pouch.
Well, back in the, when the Tevis started, they didn't use electrolytes.
So talk to us about age then. I mean, so we're hearing these incredible stories that you just shared with us. With people can, you know, they're not the horse, but they're still completing the event at these incredible ages. How is that possible? I mean, that's awesome. But
well, let me just tell you to respond to that. I was, when I was thinking about writing the book, I was thinking, I did some focus groups and said, let me hear about people who are active. So people are telling me all kinds of people are active. And I said, well, to myself, no, I don't want to just write about people who are active. I want to write about people that are still competing. And then I realized, writing down names of all these people that I knew who were my age or older who were still competing. And so that's who I, in the book, everybody that I wrote about still competing. I said, okay, I'll arbitrarily, got to be at least 65 and older. And so that's, I'm not sure if that answered your question, Faith, but basically everybody's 65 and older whose mean age is over 72.
So what type of qualities or similarities do you see in these competitors? And you're qualified to talk about it because you wrote the book and you're a psychologist.
And you're a competitor.
And you're one of them, yeah.
And on a podcast.
Mm-hmm. Qualified.
My goodness gracious.
I saved that one for the last.
Credibility is just awesome. Well, there's really a lot of factors. I'm just going to make some generalizations right now and ask questions if I don't answer it fully. First of all, in looking back, everyone's had some kind of issue in their life. Okay? So that's one generalization. Secondly, everyone played as a kid. I'm not talking about playing. We didn't have computers back then, but everybody played outdoors.
So physically active.
Physically active. They played sports and they did stuff, right? So you have that. Some people had were smart. Everybody's competitive. And people really got very efficient at what they did. Could be Jim Steer, in terms of his love for horses. He became a veterinarian. He loved horses, and he loved competing. And then he got in better physical health. And so at 85, just before he died, it was about a month before he died, he did a ride and tie. At 85 years of age.
So you're saying that people are passionate about what they do, and they get involved in it, and they just don't want to stop.
You can't stop. You can't stop. Jack Scholl, in my book, he's 85, and he's just had two hip replacements, and he's getting through rehabbing the second one. He can't wait to get back into the boat to start. He's a rower, a sculler. He can't wait. We can't stop. That is our life.
You know, here's what I've noticed, and I had a chance to run with Wally, and I'm not sure of his age, but I was told he was 77, and it could be true, and that came from a person that he knew very well. It's on the Mount Diablo team, that he just completed a 100-mile event running in 25 hours. He ran that near sub 24. He was very close to it and ended up accomplishing that. Amazing. And when you're around him, there's nothing old about him. There is nothing. He's as young and as vibrant as anybody else out there on that trail. We were all running together. When I was younger, I remember seeing an old person, and someone would say, oh, that person's 60 years old. So in my head, all of a sudden, of course, I was, five or whatever my age was, in my head, 60 looked like that. And some people that are 60 they're finished and done. They follow that path.
They look old.
But there are other people that are the opposite of that. They never look old. Wally, for instance, and you, Frank, that I'm sitting next to, I'm not calling you old, but you're older than me, but you do not, you exude energy. Exude?
That'll work.
Ginny, mule, girl.
So I like that component. Yeah, Scott, who's on Skype today, we don't let him talk unless we open up his mic. What's up, Scott?
Take me off mute. I have a question. I actually have a statement.
Okay. Once you're on, you better just keep talking.
I just got my research analysts on this and pulled up a recent list of 100-mile finishers of 70 years of age and over. And it lists here 83 men and four women, one of those being Helen Klein, that have finished a 100-mile race officially. And the oldest person is a guy named Jonathan Williams, who was 86. Back in 2010, he finished a 100-mile race in, I'm going to murder this, I've never heard of it, Chemguire?
Say it like you're from there, Scott. Just let it roll off.
Wow. No, it's Chiemguer.
Chemguire.
Yeah, whatever Faith said.
So I'm from there. It's Chemguire.
At 86, he finished a 100-mile race in under 30 hours.
Wow.
At 86 years old.
I think we're at a point here, just like we have this shirt where 26.2 is a new 50. And I'm kind of thinking here that 80 is a new 50. Mm-hmm. I certainly believe that because, like you, Don, as I progress in age into my 40s, I kind of look at people here that I remember who you know, growing up, who used to be 40, et cetera, out there. And by golly, I look at, you know, the Wayne Miles, Doug Arnolds of the world and stuff like that, and realize that these guys are in their 60s, and, you know, if I'm not nice, they're going to take me down somewhere. You know, and Doug could click me in a five-mile run, and Wayne could take me in whatever out there. So, you know, I agree with you that age is just a figment of our imaginations now, and I think you've proven that in your book, that it's just a number out there now. So,
and I think, tell me if this quote is kind of similar. You said about 30% is made up of genetics, the ability to run or be a good athlete at an older age. Like 30% is genetics, and the rest of it is finish that, Dawn. Other factors. What's in the water? What are these people drinking that they're running 100 miles, probably kicking my butt at age 86? I want that water. What's in it? I don't understand.
No, I'll read you the exact quote here. And we have the author next to us, but we're not going to ask him. We're going to go straight to the
highlighted edition here.
The Cliff Notes.
Over the years, Time Magazine has had a number of interesting commentaries and articles in reference to aging, the author writes. They reported that only about 30% of aging is genetically based, which means that other variables are under our control. Let me repeat that fact. Some 70% of how we age is under our control. When people truly grasp that significant fact, they'll realize that we are not just a product of our genes, and that we can take an active stance in how our life unfolds. Frank, expand on that a little bit.
Well, it generally that's true. I mean, there are some exceptions to that. So I'll give you an example. So growing up, my father, he was a juvenile diabetic. So basically, I grew up with illness in the family, his illness, and that's really a horrible disease. He was in the hospital a lot. My brother became a physician. So I became more interested in physical activity and sports early. And so actually in this Ride and Tie, I'll tell you about Ride and Tie in a moment, but basically with Ride and Tie, it allowed me to start running competitively, and as I ran more and more, I got in better condition. And looking back, it probably in some ways saved my life or put me in a different place, because my focus now is really on health and well-being. And through exercise is a big component. Of course, nutrition is another component. And then, of course, where we live, that's another component. So, you know, I live right near the Auburn Lake aid station on Western States. I can just about see it from my house. So what do I do in the morning? I'm on the Wendell Robey, I'm running on the States Trail. You know, I can do that every single day and night.
So at 60 years old in 2000, I should be able to do some math pretty quick here. Those are easy numbers. 2060, I should be able to get to 72. His present age. There you go. You did the Tevis Cup. We learned about the Tevis Cup at the beginning. 2 years later, you decided, I'm going to go out and run this very same course on my own 2 feet. How much running had you done before that, or was it something? You know,
I was really lucky and naive back then.
Back in 2002?
Well, yeah. So in 1997, I discovered this sport of Ride and Tie. And so I was doing an endurance ride in San Jose, California, Mount Hamilton. And a fellow by the name of Dan Barger, you may know the name, was putting on the Ride and Tie as well as endurance rides. So I was doing the endurance ride, and I looked over next to me, and there were two people that looked, they had beards, and they looked old guys, and they were doing the Ride and Tie. As it turned out, Tony Brickle, he's 60, so he was younger than me, and Jeff Windenhausen, you may know that name, He was a little older than me, so I was 50% right. Anyway, I got introduced to the president of Ride and Tie, and they recruited me because I had a horse and I had some interest.
What in the heck is Ride and Tie, Frank?
Well,
you wear a tie and ride.
You wear a tie and you ride, and so you got to hear this, Faith, because this is important, because she may be a potential Ride and Tie.
He's recruiting her.
I'm recruiting
before
her.
The show. He was trying to sway her his way.
All right, so basically, two people and a horse make up a team. All right. The team begins at the start line. You have a rider, and then you have a runner alongside. And the team must cross the finish line together. So you just can't have the runner crossing the finish line, mm-hmm. or they can't have the horse and rider cross the finish line. So that means there's strategy involved. So the rider will take off a certain distance, jump off the horse, tie it with a tie rope to a tree or something sturdy, and then continue running. Meanwhile, that runner will eventually see the horse. That's important to see the horse, because I've run by the horse. I've done that. But so you want to be able to see the horse. Untie it, get on the horse, and catch your partner. So either you'll switch at that point, or you'll ride further and then do the tying. The strategy is generally the stronger runner is in the lead always. And the idea is that when you're riding, you're resting. So depending upon the terrain, depending upon the weather conditions, so if you're going up a hill, you may tie every minute. So you have you're looking at your watch and you're riding for a minute, you may jump off and tie the horse every minute. Or if you're running on flat, you'd be maybe every 3 minutes or 4 minutes you'll switch.
Sounds like a lot of getting on and off horses.
You get on and you get off. You get on and you get off the horse.
That was always a part I wasn't good at because I'm short. It's a long ways up to the top of a horse.
You need a pony.
No, because there's double stirrups that actually for riders who have different.
So they're already on there.
They're already on there. So it's easy.
What a salesman! He's not he's not letting any objection go by.
And then if you're really really short, you can tell your partner, "Help me on the horse. I'll be in the lead, and when you catch me, you've just put me on the horse, and then we can do it that way." So
a little alley-oop action.
Right. So basically, you travel these distances. And for me, that became just a wonderful sport because it amounted to competition, teamwork. You had to condition your horse. You had to bond with your horse. And so everybody has to be sound at the end of the race, right?
You're right.
Right. So there's vet checks for the ride and tie. In the runners, there's no vet checks, as you know, right? You just keep on going. So anyway, that got me really involved in health, and I'm thinking my horse is doing these 25, 35 mile distances, so I need to be able to run those distances. What happens if something happens to my horse? I want to be able to run those distances. So in 2002, I had I qualified in 2001, so I had 4 years of ride and tie experience. I had run one half marathon, I had run one marathon, and one 50K. Those were the distances that I ran. So I'm on the trail, and a ride and tie friend to me, she says, "Hey, let's do this Western States run." This was 2001, she told me. "Let's do it in 2003. She said, "Well, let me think about it." She's young, cute. You know, it was a good idea. So I went home and I talked to some Western States people, and I said, "Okay, there's this Western States run. What do I need to do?" I said, "Well, actually, this was September, so in November is the Helen Klein mm-hmm. qualifier, right? In November." So I called her back and I said, "Linda, we can do this race 2002 if we qualify to do this 50 miler." She says, "Well, I've only run marathons." "Well, so what? I've run one marathon. So what?" I said, "Next week we'll go out and we'll do a 50K training run."
Because after all, if we do that, it's only 19 more miles to do the 50. What's 19 more miles, right? So, fresh legs back then, naive. So, I convinced her to not to do that marathon that she entered. We both did that a little training run, that 50K, and then we both ran Helen Klein. We both made the time. And we both got picked that for 2000, December 2001. We both got picked, and then we both ran it in 2002.
Better on a horse or better on your feet?
It was easier on the horse. It was easier on the horse. It was tough, but at least I wanted to be able to do that distance. But now the Western States is obviously harder than the Tevis.
And you did well because you were a division.
I was lucky. Yeah, I was just lucky. Just I didn't have that 86-year-old in my division at that time. He didn't run it with me at the time. So anyway, so then, but the ride and tie is really got me interested in running, health, because in ride and tie there's all these Western States guys like Jim Howard, mm-hmm. Ride and Tire, Tom Johnson.
Now, he raced a horse one time. There's a story about him out there.
He races, he does that.
He went overseas or something and raced a horse.
It was in Australia, I think it was. He raced the horse. And then Brian Purcell. Mm-hmm. These are all Western States winners. Mark Rickman, he came in third. There's all these guys that were running Western States. So, you know, I got to know them and talk about them. And then Chris Turney, you probably know the name, right? Chris Turney. So I trained with Chris Turney. So it was just a natural. So where we live and who we hang out with are factors too.
Right.
Right.
And how we perceive the future. Like I was talking about being a young man looking at older aged person of a certain chronological, you know, age, but we see them differently.
Well, that's important, but also for yourself.
Yeah,
you have to think about future for you.
Right.
And if you're able to think about future for you, you have a goal, and that keeps you going. Those goals, mm-hmm. future goals. If you lose sight and you lose goals, what do you have to look forward to?
So that's one of the keys.
Yeah, getting old.
Which isn't
that was it.
No, that's not it. That's,
so, you know, yeah. I have a question for Mike.
Did we turn him back on? Did we turn Scott's mic back on?
I let you out of the cage for a little
bit. Come on, you were in charge.
There?
Yeah, you were in charge of that, Faith. Yeah,
he's out of the cage.
Okay, go ahead, Scott.
This is a question for Mike Hernandez. I think you mentioned that, Mike, you have like 139 ultras under your belt. Is that right?
Something like that, yes. Uh-huh.
What motivates you to get up and train and enter that next race?
I think Frank hit it. It was simply as we age, we continue to have these goals in front of us. I continue to run because, number one, I enjoy it. Number two, it's just a great joy for me to do that. I now have, as just a single dad here, a 2- and a 4-year-old, and getting up every morning to make sure that I can try to go run is going to assist me in getting in managing these kids when they're, hopefully, I'm well 20 years down the road for me, and you know, when they're 18, 19, 20 years old, I'll still be around. That is what's motivating me now. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I don't believe age is an issue for anybody that has the correct mindset right now. If you could eliminate the mindset of what age means, then certainly we can overcome everything. Right now, I happen to travel quite a bit, and I'm going back to Nashville, Tennessee. Tennessee is probably the second or third rated obesity state, I believe it was.
Good barbecue there.
Good barbecue, though. Oh, doggone. And unfortunately, in Tennessee, the new size you know, 3 for a female is size 20. And, you know, it's a whole different lifestyle, a whole different element, and a whole different environment. So Frank commented, you know, it's your environment. And certainly around here, we live in an ultra community, and we're blessed with that. Back there, the people are not. I mean, not
that. A lot more smoking there, too.
Kentucky, yeah. Tobacco states. They still haven't forgiven the North for winning the Civil War. So there's a lot of other factors out there that we have to consider, in all seriousness, that extends our own lives here. And as we have adopted those, we're very fortunate to, I guess, to adopt it, number one, but number two, to be around people that also share our same lifestyle.
You've got to align yourself with like-minded people.
Absolutely. I mean, nothing frustrates me more than to be passed by a Don Freeman in a race, and then I can't catch him. You know, so,
That's happened, Mike.
I'm waiting for the next race, or you know, Scott to yell at me or try to trip me on the trail so I don't pass him.
You've got to watch him.
Well, you know, the one thing I've noticed about you, Mike, is because of the longevity you've had in the sport, you have such a really good perspective and a patience that comes along with it, that you know on a 50K or a 50-mile race not to start out too quick. And I think that's a mistake of a lot of newbies and even people that have been running for a number of years, that they just start out too quick. And I think that you've just developed that maturity that make you an efficient ultra runner.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think the truth really is I don't have too much speed. I have a little bit more sense now, and you're right. I generally will start slow. It's more so because I enjoy passing people at the midpoint. I know my capabilities, and then I know the fact that after you know, 50 miles in a 100-mile race, I know that everything kicks in for me, that I've been there, I know what to experience, I know the highs and lows, to your point, Scott, when you say the maturity level, and you just know that you're going to get it. It's a mindset. It's certainly planted in your head that, you know, you're just going to keep going, and you know people will come back to you. Also, mathematically, being in finance and everything else, you do know that, you know, there's going to be a high dropout rate in a race like this. You know that 3-4 out of 10 are going to fail, unfortunately, you know, and then you start working. I work through the math, and I figure that I'll be there at the end, you know, God willing. So.
I ran RDL with you, and coming back, there's a nice, beautiful stretch that goes from Cool down to No Hands Bridge, and for those that aren't familiar with it, just think of it as just one of the sweetest, gentlest downhill, very giving course with just enough technical to make you feel like you're on a trail, but not too much to slow you down, with covered with trees, and it's a cool spot within a, even on a hot day. It's beautiful. Just a place to get well, and a couple stream crossings is just great. And all of a sudden, here comes some footsteps behind me, just placed very nicely, probably a 4-foot striking. And here he comes behind me, and it was Mike Hernandez. He speeds around me, and he says, "You got to take it wide than when the trail gives it to you, Don." And one reason he is a mentor is because he does keep coming up with all those just golden nuggets. Take it when it gives it to you, and don't let it overwork you when it doesn't. And that was a good comment from you,
thanks.
Mike. So I've carried that a lot of miles, and
appreciate that.
Don, you told me that you said that.
Oh.
Are you plagiarizing? Oh,
busted.
Yep. You know, one of the things that we talked about earlier with Frank here is that it's mindset, right? It's mindset. How you perceive the world. And I've talked to people that have been in their 30s and 40s that say, "Well, I'm getting older now." Please. 30s and 40s, getting older now. I've never heard anybody on the trail in our community, and probably members of that are listening to this, are in the same mindset we are. I haven't heard anybody
say,
"I'm getting old now, I can't keep it up."
Exactly.
Hey, Don, on that same note, I'm not embarrassing you here, but put a plug in for your mom. Tell the nation about what your mom's doing.
Well,
and how she is, if she doesn't mind. I know she listens to these podcasts.
podcast, so maybe she would mind if you told her how told the nation how old she is.
Well, she's probably waiting to see if I know how old she is. She's she's 69, and she's out there running, and she's always done aerobics, and she owned her own gym, and she's always been a fitness fanatic and just loves it. And so when I set my goals and what I see my future, I look towards her and say, well, she's not slowing down at all at 69, and she's out there tearing it up. Why? I am going to as well. And whether that's true or not, that's at least my expectation. And expectations sometimes are pretty important. I'm going to let the psychologist speak to this.
No, it's true. The Well, first of all, you go into a race, and you have an expectancy, right? Back in the 70s, I did research on expectations, and just to oversimplify, I was asking school kids, fourth graders, how they expected to do on a particular arithmetic assignment. Some kids said they expected to do well. Other kids said they expected to do poorly. Clearly, the results showed that kids who expected to do well easily outperformed kids who expected to do poorly. And then, of course, the expectations that in the placebo experiments, if you're familiar with the mind-body stuff, one study, there was a group of people were told that their particular milkshake had 620 calories. Well, they were studying gut peptide levels, ghrelin levels, and that when you're full, you don't search out for more food, the chemical process. So these people were told that that milkshake had 620 calories. Their gut-tied peptide levels lowered. They didn't search out more food. The other subjects were told that milkshake had 120 calories. It's the same milkshake. Mm-hmm. What happened to their gut peptide levels? They rose. They searched out looking for more food. Just based on what they... the mind-body, the expectation again. Another experiments were about, these were hotel room attendants. And the experimenters said, you're part of this experiment, but basically what you're doing is exercise. The work that you're doing is exercise. Their body weight dropped based on what they were told.
Wow.
So if you have an expectation and it could be influenced by someone else, that influences how well you do. So if you expect to do well on a task, more than likely you're going to do well on a task. That's based, of course, on previous success experiences. Now, you can have an unrealistic expectation, right? But basically, if you have an expectation, you got to remember in terms of certain goals. Some goals have to be definable and concrete. So, for example, if I said my goal is to win the lottery, that can't be my goal because I have no control over the outcome of that. But if I say my goal is, so I'm going to run tomorrow a 10-minute mile pace for 3 miles, that can be my goal. I may or may not attain that goal, but that's measurable, that's concrete. I can determine I have the capability of doing it or not doing it based on so forth. So you have to be able to have control over your goals, which relates to your expectations and your previous success experiences. So expectancy, powerful motivator and predictor of performance.
Then I'm still going to want to win the lottery then.
You can want to win it.
That's my goal.
Good luck.
How about visualization before a race? Because now I'm lying on your couch here as you're the psychologist. How can I...
We didn't discuss fees, though.
We haven't discussed fees. How can I use some visualization to improve my expectations, my outcomes, and my experience in a long trail event?
Well, visualizations have been used a long time, started by the Russians a long time ago, especially with weightlifting. And then, of course, now it's all sports. So you could imagine, first of all, so you want to deal with the mind body on the trail, right? So that means you want to pay attention to your breathing. You want to pay attention to tightness in your body, and you want to work on relaxing. So with visualization, you start with getting yourself relaxed, going into maybe self-hypnosis or deep relaxation. And then you want to imagine, what course am I running? If it's the American River, you know the course, so you know the areas that are difficult. And so you start imagining being relaxed, being light, right? Because you know what happens at times when your legs get heavy. So you want to imagine yourself at all times being relaxed. So you focus on your breathing. And, of course, then you go through the race focusing on your breathing and being relaxed, maybe paying attention to the trees, maybe paying attention to the other runners, but basically paying attention to yourself. So you want to really focus on yourself. And if you're experiencing some tightness or something's hurting you, you acknowledge that. You don't ever deny that. You say, okay, like you said earlier, Mike, maybe you're going to have to change my pace. So if you're feeling some discomfort, you take a look at that and you incorporate that. And if you're running a 50, 100-mile race, yeah, you're going to be tired. Who's not tired, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you just pay attention to that. But you imagine yourself being in that relaxed state with your visualization. But you do that, you work on that on the trail too. So that'd be the one key. If you're like a Scott Jurek or the Spaniard, well,
Kilian Jornet.
Yeah. So these guys probably, if they do this visualization, they imagine themselves winning the race, right? And they know who their competitors are. They know in terms of their pace and when they have to push and when they don't. So depending upon where you are and what you're goals are. So if you want to do 20 hours at the Western States, then you incorporate that in your imagery too.
So what percentage of training should be physical training and what percentage mental training?
Well, I don't know if you...
It's
100% of each. 100% of each. You're always, you got to train physically.
Yeah.
And mentally, you have to train mentally too. You know that. That race, any of these races, there's a mental part because those thoughts kick in. I'm tired. I'm breathing hard. Somebody's coming up behind me. I'm hearing the footsteps, whatever it is. And you have to deal with all of that.
So of the 50% of the people that don't complete, what percentage would you say physically are out of the game? And what percentage mentally out of the game? And you're our expert here, so you could say anything you'd like.
I don't know. I really don't know, because you know that some people get injured during the race.
Right.
If you're talking about Western States, you know, you got all those dehydration, you got altitude sickness, gastrointestinal stuff, weight gain, weight loss. You have all these problems. So there's physical problems that occur. Overuse injury that occurs. You get lost. That can happen. But as you know, you got to stay with the mental, because the mental is always there in that race. You're out on that trail for 24 to 30 hours. You're there, you and your mind. So
right.
You want to so do you think, oh my God, I have another 50 miles? You start thinking that way. You're saying, well, God, I've done 50 miles. Great. Look at my time. That's super. Okay. I'm going to run to the next aid station and take it from there. So you got to keep that positive mindset always, always. And if there's something, especially with your affirmation, if you think about the affirmations like Ann Trason, one of hers was like, I think it was I can or I something, to, but it was a positive affirmation. If you take a look at anybody's affirmations, they're positive. It's not I can't. I can. Or I put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. That's positive. That's a positive affirmation. Or I'm going to run to that next tree. That's positive. It's not I can't run to that next tree. Or I can't. So I can't. You eliminate that from the from your
internal
vocabulary.
Talk. Yeah.
Eliminate that.
I would say my failures at states, which there have been a few.
How many times have you run states, Mike?
10.
Yeah, right.
10 times. I had a few failures getting to that 10.
Uh-huh.
But most of them, if I recall now, were mental. I would lose the mental edge, the mental focus. Obviously, I was in pain from other things, but the next day when you think about it, you figure, I could have run through that. I just lost it mentally. So to your point, Frank, absolutely, the mental focus is so essential in these races.
You have to have a reason for doing it, too.
Right.
For doing that run.
Yes.
There has to be a good reason, not just to do it to do it. There has to be a good reason to do it.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
Well, Frank, it doesn't have anything to do with age, does it?
Well, somewhat. Somewhat. I mean, you can't deny the age, but basically that's not the whole story. The whole story is not age. Is it?
What is the story?
The story is how you live your life and what's the choices that you make, right?
Right.
So if you're making healthy, good choices now and continue to make good, healthy choices, chances are you're going to live to beyond 78 years of age, which is the life expectancy. You're not going to become... likely have a cardiac issue, which is the number one killer in the United States. 2,600 people die a day from cardiac issues. So yeah, if you continue to make the good choices, you're going to continue to have a good life.
Well, trail running is part of a good choice, and being out there surrounding yourself with good, positive people, that's the one thing that I've always loved about the sport, not only looking at the beauty that's out there and the exercise and the challenge, but the relationships and the community is just fantastic. So we look forward to doing that. Appreciate you coming by, talking about your book.
Thank
it has
you,
nothing to do with age, by Dr. Frank Lieberman. We're lucky enough to have him in our community here, and love sharing him with the community here for our podcast.
Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
You can get that book through Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
In ebook as well.
You can also be found on a blog, right? You have a blog?
I have a blog.
Tell us about your blog.
Okay, the blog is, it has nothing to do with age, blogspot.com. Basically, I've been writing a blog, and this week's blog I started on Monday, and it's dealing with a speech that I'm, actually an essay that's based on a speech that I'm giving at the end of the month. I'm doing a speech at Lincoln Hills, senior
65
center.
65 and older community. 50,
yeah, and then I'm going down to Lawrence Livermore Lab to do a talk there in June. And then the end of June, I'm going to the Chautauqua Institute in New York.
Mm.
But and then in September, well, September is going to be really fun because are any of you guys football fans? Do you know the name Conrad Dobler?
Oh, yeah.
St. Louis.
Okay.
Cardinals, long time ago?
One of them, yeah. So I have a friend who's, I mentioned in the book, Ed Buddy, who played for the Kansas City Chiefs. And he played 13 years for the Chiefs, and he still lives in Kansas City. So he's president of the Alumni Association. So in June, he set up a couple of book signings, and he said to me, Conrad has just finished writing a book. Should we have him join us? Well, yeah, let's have Conrad join us. So we're going to do a book and autograph signings. And then, of course, they do a silent auction for fundraising. And then they do a golf tournament. So I'll be part of that. So that should be a load of fun.
Fantastic. Sounds good. And we appreciate you having here. He rolls up in a shiny red Corvette that looks so fast.